This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. Up next on our summer science issues, and it all continues. Joining me now is editor, multimedia editor, Flora Lichtman. Hi, Flora.
Hi, Ira.
Hi there.
That's right. You know how I love news you can use, and we have got more of it coming. It turns out that the grill pit is a hotbed of science. So a little later, just so you can get excited, we have a futuristic ketchup jar and the microbiology of pickles. But first, best practices for a pathogen-free picnic.
Yeah, you mean the pathogens in potato salad and stuff like that.
Yeah, you might want to pass, but don't blame the mayonnaise, it turns out. Here to clear mayo's name and to share other tips is Angela Frazier. Frazier's a professor and food safety specialist at Clemson University in South Carolina. Welcome to the show, Dr. Great. Frazier.
Thank you. Appreciate being invited.
So let's start with the mayo. Does it get an unfairly bad rap when it comes to food poisoning and picnics?
Yes, particularly commercially prepared mayonnaise. So the mayonnaise you would go to the grocery store and buy, you know, either in a plastic container or in a glass jar. The pH, or the acid level of the mayonnaise, is so low that most pathogens will not grow in it.
Wow. So when people point to the chicken salad, that's not necessarily true?
Well, it's when I'm talking about the pH of mayonnaise, I'm talking about the pH of mayonnaise in and of itself. But when you begin to mix the mayonnaise with other ingredients that have a higher pH, you alter the overall pH. And so the problem is when you're mixing what we would call low-acid foods, such as chicken, potatoes, pasta, lots of vegetables, with mayonnaise, you increase the pH. And then that type of a mixture, if it's not held at proper temperatures, can support the growth of, you know, pathogens that could make you sick.
Okay, so you could still be wary, but...
Yes.
What about melons? They seem so harmless, but I read that they can cause problems too.
Yes, and there are some fruits that also have a high pH. Let me just briefly explain what is pH. pH is measured on a scale of 0 to 14, and a neutral pH is 7. Most harmful bacteria cannot grow in what we call high-acid foods, so foods that have a pH of 4.6 or less. If the food has a pH of above 4.6, and there's a way that you measure it, that food can potentially support the growth of harmful bacteria. And so melons and some other fruits have pH values of above 4.6, making them low-acid foods. Low-acid foods must be kept hot or cold, and so obviously you're not going to keep melons hot, therefore you need to keep them cold.
And don't leave them on the counter, right?
Correct. And the general rule is you don't want to keep those types of foods on a countertop for more than 4 hours. You know, and sometimes the mistake people make is that a food might be out on a countertop for 4 hours, and they'll say, oh, forgot it, and let me just put it back into the refrigerator. No. Once a low-acid food, and we also call those potentially hazardous foods, are sitting out, you know, not under temperature control, after 4 hours, you need to either eat it up within 4 hours or throw it out.
Mm. And it's the rind, too, can pick up nasty bacteria.
Yeah, think about where, you know, you harvest a melon. It comes from the ground. I mean, bacteria are everywhere, and so bacteria in soil, in the air, on surfaces, et cetera. And so, the rind can become naturally contaminated, or it can become contaminated during the harvest process by the worker who's harvesting the melon, or even during the cleaning process or in the grocery store. You know, there's a lot of research being done on how are melons becoming contaminated, and so there's still many unknown questions.
Hmm. What about sugar? Does sugar make things inhospitable for bacteria to live in? Is that why people leave pies out?
Well, another feature of what we would call a non-potentially hazardous food, and again, a non-potentially hazardous food does not need to be kept under temperature control, is something called water activity. And so what that is the amount of water that is available for these microorganisms to function. And when you add sugar or salt or some other substances to foods, you potentially decrease the water activity of the food. So foods that have a high sugar content generally have a lower water activity, and so harmful organisms cannot grow in that food, which is why some foods, like some fruit pies, not all, can be left out at room temperature, and, you know, you don't worry about getting sick from eating them.
Mm-hmm. And is it to, what about public grills? Should we be wary?
I personally would. I was checking the research to see if anybody has actually performed a study, you know, where they've gone out and they've collected some samples, you know, surface samples, swabbed the surface of a public grill, and determined, hey, what might be on the grill surface? And I could not locate any study that had been conducted. And so my biggest concern is, you know, there's a lot of times you see these public grills, there's like a thick crust on the grills. You know, some of these pathogens might survive under that crust. We don't know. And so if you just fire it up and think that if, you know, letting the fire, you know, try to burn off whatever might be on that grill, that it would be safe, we don't know if that is true. And when I don't know if something is true, I err on the side of caution. And so what I would recommend is that you simply put like a clean piece of foil over the grill and then, you know, cut some holes in it and then put your meat or whatever you're grilling on top of the foil. That way you don't have to worry.
I will never look at a public grill the same way.
And who knows what other kind of substances might be on the grill. I mean, I would be concerned about that as well, not just microorganisms.
Yeah. What about defrosting meats and stuff out of the fridge? I've heard both. You can go both ways on that. What's the real deal?
Yeah, there is, you know, there are some people who deviate from the traditional recommendation. What I would recommend is that defrosting or thawing of raw meats, fish, and poultry should take place under what we would call temperature control. So it should take place in a refrigerator during the cooking process or under cold running water. Now, I typically don't advise consumers or anybody working in the food industry to use cold running water because it's probably not a good use of resources because you'd have to let the water run for, you know, generally about 30 minutes. So thawing in the refrigerator or during the cooking process, which would include the microwave, would be the best way.
Do you have any other take-home tips for people who are barbecuing or picnicking this summer before we have to go?
I would suggest that people prepare as much of their foods at home where they have access to water and a refrigerator. So if you're going to make hamburger patties, make the patties at home, you know, put them into a container, and so that you minimize handling at the picnic site. Another thing that I'd like to point out is we checked the CDC data, and in the past 10 years, there have actually been 193 outbreaks attributed to foods that were prepared at a picnic. And these outbreaks sickened over 5,000 people. So it can happen.
Wow. Tread carefully.
Yeah.
Tread carefully, exactly.
Well, thanks for joining us today, Dr. Frazier.
Okay, I very much appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Angela Frazier is a professor and food safety specialist at Clemson University in South Carolina.
Wow, that was interesting. I didn't realize all those hazards you got to be careful about. What else have you got for
the
us?
The hidden traps of your picnic.
Well, summer science barbecue blowout continues.
It continues, and you're going to relish the next one, Ira. Ooh, I know. Engineers at MIT who usually spend their time on trivial things like nuclear power plants and efficiency in wind turbine surfaces have finally taken on a more relevant problem. A condimentary problem, the jammed ketchup bottle. In fact, their invention could turn this sound.
Hitting that bottle, right?
You know it well,
yes.
Or at least I do, into a relic of another time.
Like the busy signal or the dial-up modem noises.
Yeah, exactly. So Kripa Varanasi, a mechanical engineer at MIT in Cambridge, and his colleagues seem to have solved this condiment conundrum. From their liquid glide jar, ketchup flows freely, no matter how little is left. And he's here to tell us about it. Welcome to the program, Dr. Varanasi.
Thank you very much.
So, you know, I always thought that this was a ketchup problem, not a jar problem. But it sounds like maybe I was wrong.
Yeah, it's actually both. But The resistance to flow mainly comes from the interface between the ketchup and the jar. And by changing that interface using this new coating that we have developed, which is super slippery, we can get the ketchup to flow out of the jar very easily without sticking to it.
So give us the simple thumbnail sketch. How does this coating work? What is it made of?
So the coating is essentially, we call it a structured liquid coating. So it has both a texture to it and a liquid that fills the texture.
Is there a way to think about this? Do you have an analogy? It's hard for me to imagine a solid liquid.
So if you, an analogy that one of my graduate student uses is, if you take gum out of, gum and try to throw it out with dry fingers, it wouldn't slide off, right? But if you have if you wet your fingers, then the fingers have a texture and the liquid would wet those textures and then the gum slides off very easily. So it is a lubricant layer at the interface, right, that allows you to slide off anything very easily.
And how do you get it in the jar?
So we are developing various manufacturing processes, and one of them is a spray-based process. And so we spray on this coating onto the bottle.
And could it come off in the bottle and then assemble itself in your intestines?
No, we wouldn't want that to happen.
No, indeed.
So the coating preferentially actually self-assembles on the jar and wouldn't come off into the food.
And the ketchup just slips right out of the jar without
exactly.
having to hit it.
And does it work on others? Does it work on anything you put in that jar? What about something thicker like peanut butter?
Yes. So what we are trying to do is engineering. So this coating can be engineered for different applications. So it could be engineered for things like mayonnaise, which are very hard to get out, and we have some demo videos that we have that were in the news. You can engineer this to slide ice, for applications like de-icing on aircraft engines or wind turbines or power lines. It could be applied to things like droplets that need to be shed in condenser tubes in power plants.
Hmm.
To, cosmetics, for example, you have a expensive
lotion. Let me just interrupt you for a second and let everybody know that this is Science Friday on NPR.
Yes.
I'm Flora Lichtman.
I'm Ira Flato here.
And we are just about out of time, but one last question. What is the coating made of?
So the coating, like I said, can be engineered out of different materials. For the ketchup bottle stuff, we used food-based materials.
But proprietary, I guess, is that?
Proprietary at the minute, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Varanasi, for taking time to be with us. This is fascinating, and I know your other work is on other surfaces, so we'll have to keep after that too, right?
Yeah.
Doctor,
thank you very much.
Thank you. Dr. Varanasi is a mechanical engineer at MIT.
All right, so we've covered ketchup and mayo. What's next on our barbecue?
Well, you might think it's mustard.
Of course.
But it's not. It's the pickle.
My favorite.
It's the pickle of the week. And it might be the pickle of every week, because it turns out I love pickle science. I didn't know this, but there are multiple kinds of pickles. So
right.
There's the salt brine, sort of fresh pickle, I found out from fermentation expert Bob Hutkins. But there are also pickles that are fermented. So you enlist bacteria to do the job for you, basically.
You have to put bacteria into the pickle jar.
It turns out that you do not have to put bacteria in. They come with, but it's a good question because they're not the only ones on the cucumber to begin with. Here's Bob Hutkins.
The bacteria that surround that cucumber are quite diverse, and many of them, in fact, most of them, are really not the ones that we want to grow. The lactic acid bacteria are probably outnumbered by 1,000 to 1 or even more by undesirable bacteria that would otherwise spoil that cucumber. So what's done is to apply this salt brine, and that salt brine, in large part, will inhibit those undesirable organisms, and they create what we call a selective environment promoting the growth of salt-tolerant lactic acid bacteria.
So it's amazing, like in every cucumber, there's this microbiological war going on in the beginning. And, you know, we help them by creating this sort of salty environment that only, the you know, from our perspective, the good bacteria can live in. So, so what occurred to me is, you know, why are these bacteria safe for us, whereas other bacteria make us sick?
Right.
And it turns out to be a really interesting story.
You know, over the course of evolution, and let's face it, these bacteria have been around a lot longer than we have, there are some lactic acid bacteria that have even the vestiges, the genetic remnants of virulence genes, i.e. genes that at one time may have been responsible for causing disease, but these bacteria have been more or less domesticated. So there is some notion that there is coevolution, that the bacteria that are associated, for example, with a healthy gut have co-evolved with humankind and have become specialized in that environment. Good for us.
The domesticated bacteria.
There you go, making pickles.
And you can make them. You
can make them at home.
It turns out, yeah, I asked Bob Cutkins, and he gave us a little recipe with the caveat that he actually hasn't made them. But he said it's really easy. And you can
try this at home.
Yeah, exactly. But you can go to our website and look how to do it. It's pretty simple. You just put them in a salt brine, and you have to get the brine right and the weight and right. But
some people put them out in the sun. I've seen people put them in the jar, and they put them out in the sun in the backyard.
Yeah. Apparently, there is some evidence that the sun helps combat the other bad bacteria. In fact, I read that even industrial makers put them in these big vats, but Hutkins said that they're usually closed. You know, you want to keep the other stuff out.
All right, Flora, thank you very much.
Sure.
Everything you wanted to know about barbecue science this hour, Flora Lichtman, our multimedia editor, and he was interviewing Bob Hutkins. Didn't get enough about pickles? Here's Flora Lichtman talking more about the science of the pickle.
I'm talking with Professor of Food Microbiology at the University of Nebraska. This is Bob Hutkins. And would it be fair to call you a pickle expert?
Well, I guess I'm an expert in fermented foods, and a pickle is a fermented food, so I guess that's fair enough.
Okay, so there are different kinds of pickles, right? Will you break them down for me?
So the pickles that we eat most of the time are actually not fermented. These are just fresh pickles that are packed in a brine. Sometimes they're pasteurized, sometimes they're not. But the pickle that's fermented is the genuine dill pickle that is actually becoming fairly hard to find these days.
Is that right?
So if you live in New York City, you can go on in a deli and you could find a pickle in a barrel, and that's a fermented pickle. But out here in the Midwest, I actually have a hard time finding pickles to bring into my class to show the student what a true fermented pickle is. I remembered from my younger days when I'd go to the grocery store and find a barrel and use tongs to pull out a fermented pickle, but it's fairly rare these days.
What is the difference? What is a fermented pickle?
So a fermented pickle is simply made by adding special cucumbers. So it's a cultivar that's designed to be fermented, and those cucumbers are put into a barrel. A salt brine is added, and then you just walk away. And within a few days, there'll be a fermentation induced naturally. So there's no addition of a culture or anything else. The bacteria that perform the fermentation live on the surface of the cucumber, and they go to work.
And when you say they go to work, what are they doing?
So what they're doing is fermenting the sugars that are naturally present in the cucumber. So when you add the brine, some of those sugars will simply diffuse out of the cucumber and into the brine where the bacteria can get at it. And these are bacteria, we call them lactic acid bacteria, that are similar to the bacteria that are used to perform yogurt fermentation or to perform sausage fermentation. And what they do is they metabolize the sugars and produce lactic acid and a little carbon dioxide and maybe even some other smaller amounts of other end products that provide some flavor to that brine. But it's the lactic acid that causes the fermentation. And when the lactic acid gets to about a 1% level and the pH drops below 4, you have a very safe, edible, quite delicious, crispy pickle.
Does the lactic acid have anything to do with the crispiness?
Not really. The crispiness is a function of the salt. The lactic acid does provide preservation. In fact, that's probably the reason why the pickle, as well as other fermented foods, evolved with humankind. But the lactic acid will prevent the growth of bacteria and other organisms that would otherwise soften the pickle. So it indirectly provides a crispy pickle.
Hmm. Are lactic acid bacteria the only bacteria that can make pickles?
Well, I guess I would say to make a good pickle, you want lactic acid bacteria. Certainly, there are some versions of fermented vegetables, not so much pickles, but in the case of olives, which are similarly fermented, yeast can play an important role, but not so much in the for pickles.
Is that just a cultural thing? Like we expect a certain taste when we bite into a pickle?
That's correct. And don't forget the fermented vegetables are around the world. So there are other cultures, whether they're cucumbers or other vegetables, that get fermented slightly, in some cases quite differently, to give you different flavors and different textures.
What happens when you eat a pickle to those bacteria that have made the pickle for you? Do they take up residence, in other words?
For the most part, they're passing through. So they'll be transient organisms. The bacteria that actually live in the gut are well adapted to that gut environment, whereas the bacteria that live in that pickle brine are well adapted to a pickle brine. And they will not be very successful in colonizing that new habitat, i.e. the GI tract. So they may survive the ride, but they're not staying for long.
I mean, we hear about probiotics like yogurts that use these types of bacteria. Does that mean that pickles, too, can have a probiotic effect?
Not really, although there is some interest in incorporating probiotic bacteria into some of these fermentations. Now, many, if not most, of the commercial yogurts that we see in our grocery store have probiotic bacteria that have been added to those products for a nutritional function. In that case, those bacteria may have the ability to have some sort of prolonged residence in the GI tract. But again, long-term colonization is probably not going to happen.
That's interesting, because I think that maybe this is just me, but I always thought that you were repopulating your gut bacteria when you ate these probiotic foods, but it doesn't sound like that.
Well, you can for a short time, and just because they're transient doesn't mean that they can't have some function in the GI tract, either by digesting nutrients, by having some immunological effect, by fighting off pathogens that might also gain entry into the GI tract. And I think this is actually a good thing if you're selling such products, because if one dose of yogurt replenished your gut microbiota and fully restored it, then you'd have a hard time convincing consumers to buy a second cup.
That's right.
Unless they really like yogurt.
Just to go back to pickle production for a second, we were talking in our editorial meeting about how sunlight is used in pickle production. Is this a myth or true?
There is some evidence that exposure to sunlight will prevent some of the yeast and molds from growing at the surface of a tank or of a vat containing pickles or other fermented vegetables. But exposure to the sunlight also means you might have exposure to flies and insects and other kinds of things. So I believe that most of these products are now made in enclosed tanks with covers over them, so that you probably aren't getting as much of the benefit of the sunlight. But I have heard that.
You have, yeah.
Yeah.
I think this brings us to the next logical question. Could you walk us through a recipe for a fermented pickle for someone who wants to try this at home?
So I have to tell you that I've not done this myself. So with that caveat, and actually I would probably recommend there's sources online that you could find to do this. But it's basically about a 5% salt brine mixed 1-to-1 by weight, 1-to-1 with pickling cucumbers in some sort of crock device or a small barrel. You could even do it in mason jars. And then take a baggie with also some brine in it and lay that on top of the of the cucumbers to weigh them down. But the idea is to squeeze out the air and try to create an anaerobic environment as best you can and also protect the pickles from the elements.
How do you know when they're done?
You should see some bubbling when the fermentation begins after just a couple of days. And it's safe to taste that brine. And when it tastes tart, I'd probably give it a week at room temperature. You probably have pickles. And very little could go wrong. There's little opportunity for any kind of pathogen to grow in this kind of brine. In fact, I'm not aware of any adverse effect by making these pickles at home, provided that you haven't improperly canned them. That would be a different story. And about a week of fermentation, you have pickles.
Sounds easy. I wonder why the dill pickle is going extinct.
America has gotten our food preferences have, I think, become less discriminating. And so we're satisfied with the standard unfermented pickle and have lost the appreciation, I believe, for that true fermented kosher dill pickle.
As a fermentation expert, do you lament that fact?
Oh, I love these. When I have the access to them, I love these fermented foods, whether it's sauerkraut or a pickle or olives. I was just in Europe earlier this summer and could not believe the array of products that were available. Especially the olives were outstanding, and it was real fun to be reintroduced to some of those products that I hadn't had for a long time.
Thanks, Bob Hudkins, for joining me today.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure to talk to you today.